This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. With summer fast approaching, more of us are getting outside to work in our gardens, play in parks, and camp or hike in the woods. That means you're likely to encounter some of the many snakes, salamanders, lizards, toads, turtles, and frogs that live in our region. Now, some of us might jump with fear when we come across these animals. Others might react with wonder and curiosity. And joining us to discuss some of the most common reptiles and amphibians you'll find in our area and how to identify them are Ludlow Schools and Gateway Community College biology teacher and past president of the Greater Cincinnati Herpetological Society, Mark Frivola, and Cincinnati Nature Center chief naturalist and adult program manager, Bill Creasy. If you have any questions about reptiles or amphibians that you might run across this summer, give us a call, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Bill and Mark, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Glad to be here, Mark. Thank you.
Mark, set me straight here so I know where I'm going with this. What is the difference between a reptile and an amphibian? I always get the two things confused.
Well, it's two different types of animals. Reptiles are scaled. Many of them have claws, except for obviously the snakes. They lay shelled eggs. The amphibians are more, they have to lay their eggs in water. Their eggs are not shelled, and they have to remain moist at all times. So like frogs, toads, salamanders are all amphibians. Turtles, snakes, crocodilians are all reptiles.
Mm-hmm. And Bill, how diverse is our area when it comes to reptiles and amphibians?
We have a nice broad diversity. We run summer camp, and sometimes we find up to 8 different species of snakes in a week. So it's got a nice diversity. It's a little bit richer and more diversity in eastern Ohio, especially the unglaciated region, but we still have a lot of nice forms here.
Yeah, do you get calls from people a lot of times at the Nature Center who have questions about what is this that I've found?
All the time.
What is this animal I came across?
Yeah, the good thing about smartphones, we also get pictures now. So it used to be they would try and describe them, and we'd do our best to try and figure out what they were. But with smartphones, they send a picture in, we can pretty much identify it every time.
What's more common when it comes to the reptiles and amphibians? Do you get more snake calls?
Mostly snake calls. So, and oftentimes those are, you know, garter snakes or the black rat snakes, the two most common snakes in our area.
And again, 513-419-7100 if you have any questions about reptiles or amphibians that live in our area. And let's talk about snakes to start off with. How many varieties of snakes do we have? Any idea?
I guess probably a maximum of a dozen. Some of them are more uncommon. There's one snake found right in the Clifton area that's not found in many other parts. Kirtland's water snake, it's an unusual snake, but it's just found in the Clifton area. Others have a wider variety of habitats you might encounter.
And as far as venomous snakes, are there any venomous snakes in this area?
None in Hamilton County. They say there's some remote pockets in Claremont County, but they've been gone from Hamilton County, which is majority of Cincinnati area, for a long, long time.
Yeah, we got a question by on Facebook from Ann, and she wanted to know if there were copperheads in Hamilton County. And in fact, she says a neighbor said he saw one in Glendale a few years ago. So I guess that wasn't a copperhead.
Well, the only thing would be if somebody had a pet collection, of venomous snakes, which, is
an
unusual situation.
Idea.
Right. Not a good idea. Need to stay with the non-venomous snakes, in my opinion. But, there's so many other snakes that people mistakenly identify. And in the 43-plus years at the Nature Center, people have brought in what they thought was a venomous snake, and it has never, ever been a venomous snake. Usually a milk snake, a hognose snake, something they're not used to seeing.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what about, are there copperheads in the northern Kentucky area?
They're very rare, especially in any of the urban areas, but I have been on calls where people call me up and said, I've got something in my yard. And like Bill said, 90% of the time it's a garter snake or a milk snake, but I have caught copperheads in rural areas in Kenton County and Boone County.
What are the other venomous snakes that you might – I know that you wouldn't encounter them in our region, but in Ohio, what else would you run into?
So the two other ones are in the rattlesnake group, and one's called a Massasauga, and they need to be in permanent swampy areas. So they're found up at Cedar Bog, and there's a population over in Spring Valley just outside of Waynesville, Ohio. But they have a very specific habitat preference, and these are like the pygmy rattlesnakes. They're small, venomous snakes. And then the eastern timber rattlesnake, and they're in, again, unglaciated Ohio. The glaciers came through the Cincinnati region. We don't have anything to worry about. So you have to be over in Adams County, Scioto County, and even those populations are decreasing. So they're very, very rare animals and need to be respected.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. We had a question come in from Tana, who said that her neighbors have noticed, and she and her neighbors have noticed more garter snakes this spring than they have in quite a while, and they also have some coyotes in the wooded area behind their home. So she's wondering, could the snakes be coming up the hill because of the coyotes, or might there be some other reason for this this uptick in snakes, garter snakes?
I don't know if there's any particular reason. Maybe it's not that they've been noticed before. Garter snakes are usually one of the first ones out after hibernation, and they tend to be looking for mates, so possibly she just witnessed a bunch of garter snakes looking for mates at a particular time. I don't know how coyotes would affect their overpopulation or anything like that.
Well, might they be chasing the snakes out of their habitat?
Coyotes tend to prefer mammals. Small mammals are the majority of their food. I know people say they're going to get the cats, and occasionally they will take one, but there's a coyote specialist up at Ohio State, and he's come to the Cincinnati Nature Center and done programs for us. And the majority of their stomach contents when they've analyzed have been mostly small mammals, squirrels, chipmunks, mice, voles, that type of thing. So the other thing is it's been a really wet spring. So maybe the garter snakes have just been looking for a drier, higher ground, and that might be one reason they're running into them.
Hmm. So, Bill, I've always wanted to know, what's up with the snake's tongue? Or Mark, since he's our herpetological expert, I've always been curious about that. What's a snake use the tongue for?
The tongue is a sense organ, much like the way you pick up chemicals with your nostrils to smell and have your brain interpret. They'll use their tongue to pick up scent, and they have an organ on the roof of their mouth, a vomeronasal organ, Jacobson organ, where the chemicals are then connected to the nerves, to the brain, and it tells them, what it is that they're smelling. It would be kind of like you going into a kitchen and sticking out your tongue and saying, wow, I smell pizza. It's not something that we can really relate to. And one of the reasons why it's forked is the same way why you have two ears. They can follow their scent to left or to right, depending upon which side of the fork is picking up the scent the strongest.
So it's for smelling.
Yes.
I would never have thought that. Interesting. Now, what about the other thing I'm curious about, too, is what is the biggest snake that we have in this area?
The largest one we'll have around here is the black rat snake, and the record is about 101 inches. Now, that's very rare. You would never.
Wow.
You would probably never find one.
So that's over 8 feet, about 8 to 9 feet. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
That's the record.
More commonly, 4.5, 5 foot is a pretty good size snake.
Are they often mistaken for being a venomous snake?
Oh, they're mistaken for being everything. Pythons, cobras, it doesn't matter. I mean, people see a big snake and they get scared and, it becomes whatever you want it to become.
Yeah, because if you're talking about something that long, it's probably, about 4 or 5 inches in diameter?
It's got a good thickness.
Yeah. 513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And what kinds of things do you look for when you're trying to identify a snake? Do you do it by scales or color, or what are the attributes you look for when you're trying to figure out what you're dealing with?
If it's something local, mainly it's just looking at the shape of the head, how big the snake is, coloration, things like that. But it's tough because snakes come in barren color patterns where they may not be the same color that you see in a picture book all the time. People say things like, you look for the pupils, and you don't want to get that close to a snake. You don't know what it is to see its pupils. So it's just a matter of experience and seeing them all the time and looking at pictures.
Nancy in Northern Kentucky joins us now. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I want to comment on the skink population on our street. All the neighbors have five-line skinks that are living on the people in the neighborhood's houses, and they're lovely, sunning themselves on our sidewalk in the sunshine, and we have many sizes. They've greatly increased since the last 5 years. I do am concerned if the Lazarus fence lizards will come in and take over the native five-line skink population. Would you like to talk about how those lizards got to Columbia Tusculum a few years ago? I have friends in Price Hill who also have both the fence lizard and the five-line skink living in the brick mortars of their house, too.
Okay, Nancy, thank you. Let's talk about the skink first. What is a skink?
So it's a group of lizards that are fairly easily identifiable by the fact that their scales don't have a keel. So some reptiles, snakes and lizards have this keel like the bottom of a boat on each individual scale. And it gives them a rough feeling or a rough texture when you hold them. Others, it's totally smooth. So skinks have smooth scales, and they're a really neat group of lizards. The five-line skink is, you know, in the area, but it's so beautiful as a young one. The little juveniles have this blue metallic tail that's absolutely incredible color. And then the Lazarus lizard, sounds like Nancy knows the story. But, yeah, they came in through the
And this is an interesting story, too.
The Lazarus boys, yeah. Again, it's been said so many times, I'm not sure if my rendition is appropriate, but they were said to be in northern Italy on vacation. They caught six or eight of the lizards and put them in their socks, tied the socks closed, put them in the luggage, and brought them back to Cincinnati. And then upon return, they put them out in their backyard. And the northern Kentucky is a temperate area. Northern Italy is a temperate area. And so just like Cincinnati, they were used to the four seasons. They took hold, they started breeding, and they have traveled everywhere. By natural population growth, they are all along Eastern Avenue and well into Hyde Park area. It's interesting to hear you talk about the fact that they have both five-line skinks and the Lazarus lizards, because that's something I'm not sure anybody studied as to which is going to be more dominant and if they can survive together or whether the Lazarus lizard might be a more aggressive species. Oftentimes, exotic animals or plants that come to the area can outcompete the natives. So it's an interesting topic.
Now, we got an email going along with this topic on skinks. This is from James, who says he saw a broad-headed skink at California Woods a couple of weeks ago. And he notes that the Ohio Department of Natural Resources website says they're only found in a few southern counties, and they're rare. What about the populations in our area?
This is a larger skink, and we actually have a healthy population at the Cincinnati Nature Center. You kind of have to know where they are to see them. But it's a really handsome animal. They get up 6 to 8 inches, so it's a big skink, whereas the five-line—
And they're called broad-headed because the head is larger. And
right. They have a coppery-colored head and kind of a tannish body, and they have just large jaw muscles, which gives the head its large size to be called broad-headed. But, they're really interesting lizards, and I imagine they're just, like so many other things, adapting to humans and moving into some of our local woodlots and wild areas.
More snakes, lizards, salamanders, and toads coming up. If you've got any questions or comments about reptiles and amphibians, you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and my guest this afternoon, Ludlow Schools and Gateway Community College biology teacher and past president of the Greater Cincinnati Herpetological Society, Mark Frivola, and Cincinnati Nature Center chief naturalist and adult program manager, Bill Creasy, as we explore the reptiles and amphibians you're bound to come across in your summer adventures. You can be part of the conversation, 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Mark, any thoughts about, people's normal reaction to snakes is to go, oh, they're scary things. Any thoughts on why people have this aversion to snakes and on the value of snakes themselves, though? I mean, if you get past that aversion, you have to realize they're an important part of the ecosystem.
Ophidiophobia, which is a fear of snakes, throwing some big words there at you. I think most of the time it's learned from other people. Little children are not really afraid of snakes. We do a lot of programs at the museum and such, and little kids will come right up wanting to touch snakes, and the parents just, no, don't touch. And I think they learn more from their parents, who probably learned from their parents, maybe had a bad experience here and there. But you're right. You know, around here, and as Bill said, there's nothing really dangerous that you should worry about. You know, just respect them, obviously. But they serve a really important place in our ecosystem, controlling the mice and other rodents that actually compete with us for food and spread a lot more diseases than the snakes do themselves.
Mm-hmm. In addition, if I could add something, they're a food source for other animals. I have a woodlot behind where I live, and we've had red-shouldered hawks nesting, and the hawks will bring snakes into their babies. So they're all part of the system. They, eat other things, and then they provide food for the larger predators than them.
So you think snakes get a bad rap?
Definitely. We all know they do.
513-419-7100. Tina in Hyde Park joins us now. Hi, Tina.
taking my call.
Go right ahead.
My question is a follow-up on the other caller's concern about the lizards, the Lazarus lizards. I do live in Hyde Park and see many, many of these lizards. I was wondering if they're a danger, being an invasive lizard. They don't seem to have any natural predators, and I'm concerned about the insects and them consuming the bad as well as our good insects. And my neighbor has this amazing butterfly garden, and they've had it for about 6 years. The last couple of years, we've noticed less and less caterpillars, butterflies, pollinators. I'm wondering if these lizards have anything to do with their demise.
So you wonder if they're damaging to the environment.
Yes, it's a huge concern. They're not native.
Yeah, it seems to be a legitimate concern, especially with a pollinator garden. You know, our pollinators are having all sorts of hard times from multiple factors out there. So it's great that your neighbor has one of these, and we encourage people to plant more pollinator gardens. And in fact, the Nature Center has given away free milkweed seeds at the local Graders and La Rosa's that can pick up milkweed seeds for the pollinators. It might be an impact to have these lizards in an area like that. And I would just hope that there might be some other predators who would take advantage of the lizard population and try and bounce all this out. But it's a new area for us. We're not sure, you know, what their impact is.
Nick in Villa Hills joins us. Hi, Nick.
I'm a little late on my statement. A couple years ago, I was picking slate out of a friend's yard in Walnut Hills, and it's kind of an overgrown yard. And we came across a baby copperhead, and boy, was he aggressive. But, you know, I'm a little late on that one. But I have a question about the lizards. How are these things surviving our winters?
Where they occur in northern Italy, it's a European wall lizard, and they naturally are used to temperate environments. So they're used to cold winters, and they don't have any problem with that.
Any thoughts on what he might have found, copperhead or otherwise?
If he could get a picture, if anybody out there listening thinks they have a copperhead and could get a picture from their yard, it would be worthwhile to note that. And you can get it to the Cincinnati Nature Center or the Greater Cincinnati Herpetological Society at cincyherps.com.
Now, do most snakes like the same general type of environment? Because I always kind of wonder why they end up hanging out in you know, porch stoops and wood piles, that kind of place. Is that just ideal for the snake?
Well, being cold-blooded like that, they do have a certain amount of requirements that they all share, such as, you know, warming themselves and sunning themselves. So they will go to some place warm where the sun is shining in the morning so they can warm up and then go about their business during the day. But different snakes will have different habitats. For example, water snakes are going to be near creeks. Queen snakes be near creeks. There's a lot of different ground snakes we have, like brown snakes and such that go underground and are more fossorial. And then the black rats and black racers, which tend to be more active during the day, moving around, you know, following, you know, tree lines and things like that.
Do we have like water moccasins in this area or even cottonmouths? Do those, because my cousin and I used to have these debates. He used to swear up and down that we had both of them in this area. So
there's no cottonmouths or water moccasins, the same snake in this area. We're too far away from the Mississippi Valley and too north. There are some in western Kentucky, you know, like I said, along the Mississippi Valley, but not here.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time what you see around here are common water snakes or northern water snakes, and they tend to get big, they tend to get dark, and they are rather aggressive.
So you can
aggressive.
Easily mistake them
yes,
for
definitely.
Being a venomous snake. How do you spot a venomous snake, by the way? I mean, what's the difference between – how do you know if what you're looking at might be venomous or just an ordinary snake?
Just from a distance, you know, if you don't know, the best thing is just stay away. One of the common things, obviously, is just learning what they look like. You know, there are certain similarities around here or, you know, in this part of the United States, the venomous snakes tend to have that triangular head. But that doesn't hold true in Florida and other places in the world. So just basically, you know, knowing what they look like to begin with.
And if you're not sure, just
stay away.
Stay away.
Right.
And you can go to sites like Google Images and look at what the real thing is. You know, what does a copperhead look like? What does a timber rattlesnake look like as compared to what you may have found in your backyard and taken a picture of with your smartphone? Also, the Division of Wildlife, Ohio DNR, has some great booklets that they put out. and they're free. You can contact them. I think your website might list a link to that.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the only natural history series I know of produced by any state. So there's one on reptiles, one on amphibians, one on mammals, one on butterflies, one on moths. Just incredible field guides free to the public. And then you can also help support that by doing the tax check off on your Ohio state taxes. Division of Wildlife, you know, the money's not in your pocket yet. It's kind of out there floating. Give a few bucks to the Division of Wildlife to help the production of these great publications.
And we do have links to that on our website as well as to the Kentucky Snake Identification site as well.
Great.
513-419-7100 to join us. And let's talk with Rob in Fort Thomas. Hi, Rob.
Hi. I was interested in the discussion earlier where you were talking about the impact of glaciation on the types of snakes that we have in the area. And I was wondering if you could just explain a little bit what that really means.
Glaciated versus unglaciated and how that's affected where the snakes choose to live.
Well, I don't have a background in geology, but basically there were, you know, glacial periods and glacial advances into this area. The Ohio River used to flow north of Cincinnati. And the four common glaciers back in the textbooks when I was in college in the 60s and 70s were Nebraska, Kansas, Illinois, and Wisconsin. And those first three went through Ohio, pushed, you know, all the way down to where the Ohio River is now located. The last one stopped north and melted and produced the hills and valleys that we see all around the area. But those glaciers did not get into southeastern Ohio. And so if you go over there, you'll think you're in the Smoky Mountains. The topography is really different, much higher diversity of birds, reptiles, amphibians, and it's the Little Smokies of Ohio. Great area, great natural history.
Aaron in Sharonville joins us now. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can. Go right ahead.
Okay. I was just calling. I work at Sharon Woods, and a couple weeks ago we had people come up to me and claim they thought it was a cottonmouth. It had gotten out of the lake and had a small catfish in its mouth. And so we were curious as to whether it was just, I mean, I'm assuming it was probably just a common water snake.
Right.
So I was wondering if rat snakes or any other land snakes are known to fish for food.
And Mark, you were saying that even the common water snake, the non-venomous type, can be pretty aggressive.
Right. That's right. And most of the larger terrestrial snakes, like the black rat and the black racer, they tend to like warm-blooded animals. Or the black racer will eat other snakes, but I've not known them to actually go into the water to look for fish. Most likely, you are correct, and what you saw is just a common northern water snake.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Dennis sent us an email, and he says he found tadpoles in a pool, in his pool cover. And so he's wondering about, can his daughter raise these to frogs, and what should she do to care and feed for them?
I've done this, actually.
Have you?
In my classroom, yeah. We have a pool cover.
And you've been teaching for what, 28
years?
28 years,
yeah.
Okay.
And we have a pool cover just like you stated. And we have, in northern Kentucky, we have the toads and the tree frogs that breed in that pool cover every year. And my wife will not allow me to take the pool cover off until I remove all the tadpoles. So when my kids were younger, we took a bunch of them and stuck them in a little fish tank, put a little filter in there. We dropped in a little flake food, a little bit of moss and things like that. And the tree frogs metamorphosized pretty quickly. They kind of crawled out of the tank on their own within, you know, a month and a half or so. So if you keep them in a fish tank like that, you just make sure that they don't climb out on their own. They'll be all over your house.
Now, the rest of the note says they're living in a bucket right now. So how do they feed them? Do they need to add water to the bucket, type of water that's safe? Or you're saying a fish tank's better for this?
You know, as long as, you know, you keep them in a bucket, they still – you know, they come on a ground cover there on the pool cover that's kind of stagnant water to begin with. So
they can stand up. They can withstand a lot.
Right. We just kept it in a fish tank just because it looked better.
And you can use rainwater, or if you take tap water and let it sit out for the chlorine to, you know, evaporate, let it sit out 24 to 48 hours, you can use that.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And Dan in Delhi joins us now. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Love the conversation. I just My father's owned a couple pet stores for a very long time, almost 30 years. And one of the things when we were really into herps, me and my brothers, was people bringing them up all the time, telling us that they just killed a water moccasin and killed a copperhead, and then they would show us it in a bucket. It was always not a venomous snake. And then when we explained to them all the good things they did, like eating their mice and around their house and things like that, people were usually disappointed. But I just think it's great that you guys point that out, even though you should stay away from them if you're not sure, because there is a chance somebody let one go in the area, is that most of these things do more good than harm. And especially, they'll leave if there's no more mice to eat. That's what I always really would tell them. If there's nothing for them to eat, they're going to leave and they'll go someplace where there is. So, and I appreciate you guys doing that work, telling people that.
Thank you, Dan.
Excellent point. I'm glad you brought that up, because I as well get a lot of people that tell me how they've killed a snake in your yard and everything, and show me pictures. And just like you said, they're relatively harmless. And I don't think people really appreciate, all the good that they do in the ecosystem.
I even had a physician one time out of Claremont Mercy say that he was treating somebody, and he knows what copperheads are because he grew up in West Virginia. And I said, oh, is the snake still there? He said, yeah, they killed it. I said, well, you'd love it for the Nature Center collection. They brought it out to us, and it was a harmless milk snake, not a copperhead at all. So we've never in 43 years had a venomous snake brought into us.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to talk with us. And Iris in Spring Grove joins us now. Hi, Iris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm new in town, relatively new. And walking in the vicinity of Spring Grove this past spring, I noticed on two occasions, unfortunately, flattened on the road, a smallish, bright blue snake. So two separate times, these bright blue snakes, and just wondered what those could be.
I'm guessing that it may have been some discoloration from the animal. I've seen garter snakes that have been hit on the road, and they end up turning blue for whatever reason. I don't know if that's something to do with the stomach acids that are so powerful in them, or just the way the chemical breakdown of the pigments. But yeah, they sometimes do pick up this bluish cast. I know what you're talking about, but I'm sorry, without a picture, I'm not quite sure what the species might be.
513-419-7100. Let's talk with Joanne in Hamilton. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have the phobia of which you spoke about snakes, and my son built a raised bed stone garden for me, and I went out, and the first day I saw a black snake, maybe about 16 inches long, with a yellow stripe on its back, and I immediately came in the house. So then the next morning I went out, and there was a much larger version, and it looked like older because the skin was real, I don't know, sort of scaly and dry-looking, a much larger version, kind of curled up in sort of a figure eight, maybe just sunning there. And I don't know what they are, and I've not been able to plant my tomatoes or basil. So I wonder if you could tell me.
Can't say blame you.
Do they keep coming back to the same holes? I did find two holes out there, and would there be a way that I could gently remove them from my garden area?
To address your initial snake sighting, most of the time, any snake that you see around here on land that has stripes like that, a stripe down the back, is probably going to be a garter snake. If the stripe goes long ways down the back, it would be a garter. If it was just a ring around the head, it could be a ringneck snake. But and they're both harmless. The ringneck snake is much, much smaller and a light gray. The garter snake tends to be a darker, blackish color, like you said, as well. As far as the bigger snake with the loose skin, as snakes grow, they tend to shed their skin. They literally outgrow their skin, and it gives it a very, very rough-looking appearance. It's hard to say exactly what you might have seen without seeing a picture. And another thing that you mentioned, the snakes don't actually dig holes like people always say, snake holes and whatnot. Now, they will find, holes in the ground that may belong to some other animal and find, comfort in there or hide under something like that. As far as getting rid of them, they will follow a food source. If there's no food there for them to eat, you know, they're not going to hang around. There's no reason to them. Reason for them to hang around.
The only situation may have been that you create a nice sunny spot for them to get away from the ground and get up high and get a nice sunbath to activate them, as Mark talked about earlier, so they can then go out and carry on their daily business. But they might just sun in the early mornings and then move away once it gets too hot.
What about if you get a snake inside your house? What's the best way to safely remove a snake from the house? Put a breadcrumb trail out and say, go follow that snake?
If you can find a large cardboard box, a garbage can works too, but there's usually a lip involved on a garbage can, but some large container that's fairly deep, and then just take a broom and gently encourage them into that box, lift it up, and they usually have smooth sides. If the box is nice and deep, then you can take it outside and release it.
I received a call once from a woman that was frantic about a snake in her house, and it was somewhere in Ohio. I don't remember exactly where. And I went over to her house, and she had a large hole in the side of her house right next to her door. And I thought, well, this is probably where it came in. And, you know, I went in, look, and I couldn't find anything. I asked her about the hole, and she had literally taken a shotgun and tried to shoot the snake that crawled up the side of her house and blew a hole through the side of her house. So that's ophidiophobia at its extreme.
Yeah. So, Bill's, I think your suggestion is probably the better way to handle it.
Right. Just try and sweep them into a box.
Sweep them into a box. We will continue our conversation, and you can join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Joining us to talk about some of the most common reptiles and amphibians you'll find in our area and how to identify them are Ludlow Schools and Gateway Community College biology teacher and past president of the Greater Cincinnati Herpetological Society, Mark Frivola, and Cincinnati Nature Center chief naturalist and adult program manager, Bill Creasy. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we got an email from Elizabeth who is talking about how Ohio Department of Natural Resources Management has told its naturalists they can't let participants touch snakes during their programs. And she says, I find that ridiculous. She says, my daughter was introduced to snakes by a state naturalist and loved holding them, and she now loves snakes. And she says, having a state naturalist teach kids how to respect and hold snakes in a safe and controlled manner is the best way for kids to learn about snakes. And she says all this is going to do is teach people that all snakes are dangerous. So she was wondering if Bill and Mark, if you could comment on that.
I agree with you totally. And as a matter of fact, in today's society with people being so happy, I think the Department of Natural Resources really has no other choice, you know, for insurance purposes other than to keep control of the animals at all time. But being a teacher, I keep snakes in my classroom. And these are snakes that I have raised myself, and they're used to being held and being around, you know, people all the time. And I let the kids hold them. And I think what you said is absolutely correct. It's a great way to get kids to appreciate nature and to get them to appreciate the natural world. You know, a lot of these kids come into my classroom at the beginning of the year. They're scared of snakes or they don't like science. And by the end of the year, you know, they see all their peers holding the snakes and, you know, watching them and cleaning them. And they like snakes and they take a real interest in science. And if a kid leave the classroom saying, you know, now I like science. And it's a good way to get them started.
I grew up in a family with three other brothers, so mom and dad allowed us to have all sorts of pets, except mom said no snakes.
No snakes.
So, of course, you know, I had a high school teacher similar to Mark with snakes in the classroom, and I just couldn't believe it. It was so great. And so in the summertime, he allowed students to have this different snake as long as you brought a note in. So I said, hey, mom, let me get out of my system. Let me just take care of one for the summer, and I'll keep it in the garage. Well, she got used to seeing me hold it. She learned about it. Most of our fears are from lack of knowledge. Whatever our phobia or problem might be, is we just need to learn more about that. And so she became cool with snakes. And in fact, she became the first Head Start teacher in the city. And I took the snakes down to her little four-year-old inner city kids. And those kids had no fear. They just came right up to the snakes. So I think it's great for situations where people can touch snakes and learn to hold them as long as it's in a supervised situation.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk with Linda in Bethel. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Good to talk to you. Thanks for taking my call. I was cleaning out some window wells, or maybe 3-foot deep and trying to get the leaf debris out, and found some black salamanders that had yellow spots. And this was a large salamander. I mean, you know, close to thumb size as far as thickness.
They're big salamanders. Yeah. What you found was a spotted salamander. It's a really handsome animal, about 6 inches long, and beautiful yellow spots on it, and is a state amphibian for Ohio. So it's a really handsome animal. It's in a group called mole salamanders, and that's for the very simple reason that they'll come to breeding pools in the spring, but then they go back to the environment, and they basically disappear. Mark used a word earlier, fossorial, which means they're burrowing. So oftentimes they're underground, and people might find them if they're, you know, digging the garden out or digging a trench or something like that. Sometimes actually occupy old mole runs underground. But it's a beautiful animal called the spotted salamander.
What's the difference between a lizard and a salamander?
It's what Mark referred to earlier.
Lizards are reptiles. They have scales. They have watertight skin. They lay their eggs on land. Salamanders are amphibians where they do not have scales, and they have to lay their eggs in water, so they must remain in a moist environment all the time.
Again, 513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And Lanita in Lawrenceburg joins us now. Hi, Lanita.
Hi. I have a question. Last year, out here in southeastern Indiana, there was a rumor going around that our turkey population was getting out of control and that they had released rattlesnakes to control the population by eating the eggs. And I was wondering, is that true? And if it is true, where are those rattlesnakes now?
I hope not anywhere near you.
Yeah, I know. So do I. So thank you.
Rattlesnakes are not known to be egg eaters like that, first of all. They much prefer small, warm-blooded mammals. They have the heat sensory pits, which detect warm-blooded animals. It's not that a snake might not occasionally eat a bird egg or something like that, especially the climbing snakes like the black rat snakes that can get up into a bird nest. But a turkey egg, if you look at that, it's a pretty good size, and I think it'd be a challenge for any of our local snakes in Ohio, venomous, non-venomous, to try and swallow a turkey egg. That is a big, big egg.
513-419-7100. Let's talk to Grant in Goshen. Hi, Grant.
Hey. During the last 3 weeks or so, I've stopped and moved about over a dozen turtles off the road, and snapping turtles, box turtles. And I'm just wondering, it seems like every year this time of year, they're out in the road. And I was wondering why.
Well, thank you.
Springtime thing, I take it.
Yeah, it's a springtime thing. They're looking for mates. They're mating. Snapping turtles wander around, look for new aquatic bodies of water. So they're known to be nomadic. But thank you, first of all, for doing that. Breaks my heart when I see a turtle that's been run over on the road. Of course, you need to maintain your safety and your car and so forth. But you should never move a turtle back to a park or to your own yard. They become, as they grow up and mature from a small hatchling, they become familiar with their own territory. And research has been done that if you move them somewhere else, they don't know the proper places for food, water, shelter. So just take them whatever direction they're headed on the road, take them to the other side, whichever way their head's pointing, and get them off the road. And thank you for doing that. That's great. Some of these reptiles, especially turtles, their numbers continue to drop year after year.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about turtles. Start with snapping turtles. How common are they in this area?
They're in almost every body of water you've got around here. They're fairly common. And they get really big. They get the size of a garbage can lid, some of the really old snapping turtles. They're not alligator snappers. A number of people always say, I found an alligator snapper.
That's what I've always heard too.
But that species is definitely a southern species, and they have three distinct ridges going down their back. And you can tell them easily from our common snappers, which get just really good size.
Are snapping turtles aggressive by nature?
They're much more aggressive when they're out of the water than they're in the water. If they're in the water, they're much more likely to just swim away from you and just try to get away. But on land, they just feel threatened. Some of the big females this time of year will be looking for a place to lay eggs, and that's usually what people come across on the road. And, of course, if you approach them, you know, to them, you're a big predator coming after them. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be aggressive, yes.
So just like snakes, don't go near it.
Right.
What's the most common kind of turtle that we have?
Probably snapping and box turtles.
Box?
If you go canoeing on the Little Miami River, you'll see our soft-shelled turtles. They look like a big flat pancake. And they're the first, you know, if you're the first canoes out, you'll see lots of them all along the riverbanks. But box turtles and snapping turtles?
A lot of times in the water bodies around here, because of years and years ago, the red-eared slider has really taken over. You know, they used to sell them as pets, you know, when I was a kid, and people would buy them, and, you know, most of them died, but if they got too big, they didn't want them anymore, they just throw them in local water bodies, and they've really spread into this region, and they are just all over in water bodies.
Do we have musk turtles in this area?
Rarely, but occasionally one will show up here and there, but they're not very common.
513-419-7100, Tom in Union, Kentucky joins us. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. The conversation is really timely because just over this past weekend, my wife and kids and I were playing outside for about an hour. Our kids are 3 years old and one. And my son was swinging on the swing. We looked down, and there is this four-foot black snake right underneath him, just a couple of feet from my feet. So we got out of there. We ran into the house, and we looked out. There are actually two of them, maybe about 20 feet apart. Each about 4 foot long, about the length of a broom, probably at their thickest point, about as thick around as the handle of the broom. So really large snakes, and what concerned us was that they, we had been out there for a while, they had no fear of us, and frankly, since then, my wife and I have been afraid to go out into the backyard for fear of these guys being out there and letting our kids play because they seem to have no fear of humans. So the question was just around what should we do, and is there a way to keep smaller kids safe from any type of interactions like that?
Well, I would say you just continue your regular activities and don't worry about them. Most of the time, the snakes are going to avoid you if they can. If you get too close to them, you know, like I said before, you're to them a large animal and they're going to try to avoid you. If it was solid jet black, most of the time it's a black racer. Black rat snakes around here tend to have a bit of a greenish dark pattern to them. But if, like what you're describing, if it's a shiny solid black, it's a black racer. They're mouse eaters. You know, they're not going to try to attack you or your children or anything like that. They're just going to try to get away like any other wild animal would.
If you accidentally step on a snake, will it bite or will it still try to just get away?
From my experience, most of the time they just try to get away from you.
And what about non-venomous snakes? They might even try to bite if you're not careful.
Well, right. If you go ahead and grab them, like I said, you know, you're a predator and they're trying to defend themselves and they will try to bite just to get away. You know, it's a common reaction, but they're not going to go after you in any manner. You're way too big.
Let's talk with Jack in Norwood. Hi, Jack. Hello, Jack. Are you there?
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, yeah, thank you. No problem. Go right ahead.
Taking my call. So I ended up with two statements. Well, a statement and a point. Yeah, save turtles, always. I've done them many times. I have a snake in my house, so back to the teacher's comment about educating children about snakes and, you know, removing that fear. I got four kids in my house, and plus my two, and, you know, they're all comfortable. They want to play with him. They will hold him, which was just great. And it took that fear away. But now my question is I do have the skinks at my place there in Norwood. And I have a raised yard, so it's got a wall and concrete steps. And, you know, that's where they love to be. And I have both the lizard and the five stripe. And I was just really curious about what their diet is. Because I have a, you know, there's a lot of little, some people on water bugs, some people on Japanese cockroaches around my home. And I was wondering, you know, what is their diet?
Any insect that moves in front of them, they're opportunistic. And so whether it's a quote, water bug or a grasshopper, small green caterpillar, anything that's moving in front of them, both of these lizards are going to go after insects.
Let's talk with John in Wilmington. Good afternoon, John. John, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, John?
John.
Oh, okay. Go right ahead.
Two questions. First question, could pit vipers be introduced to this area? I know they're not naturally from this area, but could they be introduced and survive and thrive in this area? That's my first question.
Well, the term pit viper is a whole group of animals. Like rattlesnakes, for example, are pit vipers. Copperheads are pit vipers. You know, it's just a term generalizing the fact that they use heat-sensing pits in order to get their food. If you're referring to like tropical pit vipers,
like the pit vipers like rattlesnakes, cottonmouth, water moccasins, the ones that you would typically find in this part of the country?
There's been no effort to reintroduce or introduce those to any areas in Ohio that I'm aware of, and most of those species are in decline because of human interaction, and a lot of people, you know, the only good snake's a dead snake, unfortunately. So where they are already established, there are some, you know, pockets located throughout the state of Ohio where there are pit viper populations, but more than likely, it's in the unglaciated part.
All right. My second question is, what could I do on my property to encourage a snake habitat?
One of the things when we started our little reptile roundup camp at the Cincinnati Nature Center was to introduce sheets of metal, which we just call tin. You can also use old pieces of plywood. But at the interface between the forest and the field, we put these down so that there is a refuge for these animals to get away from predators, get away from weather conditions. And so our success at finding snakes at camp increased. It doubled or even tripled with the amount of snakes we could find once we provided cover down for these animals, something for them to hide under.
Let's talk with James in New Vienna. Hi, James.
Hi. Hello.
Go right ahead, James. You're on.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I was just calling about you know, that lady that had found the garter snake on the road, or and it had a bluish tint.
Right, the snake that had the bluish tint. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't it reptilian blood? I've always heard it was blue. Isn't that? Is that so?
No, it's still red, just like mammalian blood, more or less. Sometimes with the tint, the way the scales and the different pigments reflect light, when the animal is dead, like Bill said, the pigments tend to degrade, and that kind of gives off a different tint to it. But snake blood is red.
You know, I think the notion that it's blue comes from the idea that they're cold-blooded. Is that where that's coming from?
The whole idea of cold-blooded, I guess it could. I'm not quite sure where the notion came from. Just means that they're at the mercy of the environment. They cannot generate their own body heat as we can.
Now, yeah, we haven't talked about frogs and toads yet, which is, I always get confused on these, Bill. I always think a frog's a toad and toad's a frog, and I can't tell the difference between the
all
two.
Right,
so
if you can,
keep
if you,
me straight on this.
If you can catch it easily, chances are it's a toad because they're little hoppers. You know, they'll hop 4 or 5 inches. Now, it might still be a challenge because they continually move, but when a frog takes off, it really makes a jump, and it could be, you know, 2 feet or, you know, 5 feet. They have very strong back legs. They're used for swimming, and toads are usually rough textured skin, where frogs tend to be more smooth. And they both go to the water to lay their eggs.
So, what are the common types of frogs, toads, and that we would have in our area?
The American toad is our most common toad, and it can be identified by the color spots on its back. Usually, it just have one or two warts or bumps on each color spot. There is a less common one called a Fowler's toad, and that usually has 3 or 4 lumps within each color spot. The common frogs, if you're around a pond in the summer, you're going to hear bullfrogs and green frogs. And there is something called a fold that comes back from behind the ear, and on the bullfrog, it just curls right around the eardrum. On the green frog, it extends down the back. And there's a lot more, but those are the three most common species people, you know, run into.
So wrap it up for us. Just your advice, if you come across a snake, a turtle, or any other animal, Mark, what would you tell people to do?
To admire it from a distance. You know, don't try to kill it. Don't try to move it. Don't try to hurt it in any way. They have a place in nature, and just, you know, admire them and know that they're there for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Bill?
I agree completely. They're just a great part of our biodiversity here in this area, and it's nice to run across something like that when you're out on a hike.
Well, Bill and Mark, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ludlow Schools and Gateway Community College biology teacher and past president of the Greater Cincinnati Herpetological Society, Mark Frivola, and Cincinnati Nature Center chief naturalist and adult program manager, Bill Creasy.